It is hot outside, and we're going to heat things up in your head with this week's installment of the Far Middle Podcast. Hi, everybody. It's Nick. And what a summer so far, and I'm enjoying every minute of it. I sincerely hope you are as well, and that as a constant listener, this helps make the week a little more fruitful and fulfilling. Now, this week's sports dedication has a strong connection to Los Angeles, which will in turn have a connection to the front half of this episode, because we're going to discuss the second part of the speech I delivered at the Jonathan Club in downtown LA earlier this summer. A few hard truths, so to speak, but more on that in a minute. First, a dedication for Far Middle, 166. This man is a legend in a sport because he did it all and on every level. And he's got the nicknames to prove it. Nicknames as in plural. Now, remember a few weeks back when we did our dedication to Frank Robinson, we said the greats will typically have statues built in their image, but that he had, Frank Robinson, did three statues in three different cities he impacted, which was very impressive. Well, this week's dedication has four, count them, four nicknames. His nicknames included the logo, in reference to his silhouette being the basis for the NBA logo, Mr. Clutch, for his ability to make a big play in key situations, such as his famous buzzer-beating 60-foot shot that tied Game 3 of the 1970 NBA Finals, Mr. Outside, in reference to his perimeter play with the Lakers, and then my favorite, the fourth and final nickname, since I'm a proud Appalachian, which is Zeke from Cabin Creek, for the creek near his birthplace outside of Charleston, West Virginia. Now, you probably know at this point who we're talking about. It's the great Jerry West, who we sadly lost earlier this summer. Boy, West achieved greatness in basketball just about every way imaginable. Now, he grew up in pretty tough conditions, from a poor family in a small coal community with his dad, who was abusive, specifically to Jerry West. Basketball, however, that proved to be his outlet and sort of his therapy. And here's a really interesting fact about him. So West in high school, of course, was a phenom on the basketball court. And he led his high school, which was known as East Bank, to a state West Virginia championship back in 1956. And that sort of championship was won on March 24th of 1956. So from that day forward, it prompted East Bank High School to change its name officially to West Bank High School every year on March 24th to honor Jerry West. And that practice remained in effect until the school closed in 1999. How cool was that? Now, Jerry West was a standout at West Virginia University and college, where he led the Mountaineers to the 1959 NCAA championship game. He was the co-captain of the 1960 U.S. Olympic gold medal team, and that was a squad that was inducted as a unit into the Basketball Hall of Fame. Now, who was the other co-captain along with Jerry West? The Big O, Oscar Robertson. So there's a duo of epic leaders for you. And everyone knows what Jerry West did in the NBA, a stellar 14-year career with the LA Lakers. In many ways, he redefined the guard position. I mean, come on, West was a 12-time NBA first and second team All-Star, 14-time All-Star in the NBA. He was an All-Star Game MVP. He was the definition of an all-around great player. By the way, he was on his defensive skills. He was a member of the first five NBA all-defensive teams, which wasn't introduced until he was 32 years old. So he was a great defensive player. He only won one NBA title, but he did get one in 72 with the Lakers, but he played in nine NBA finals total. So he was 1-8 in the NBA finals. He lost 8 of the 9 years that he made it there. And that's what happens when you are in the same era as the Bill Russell-led Celtics. The Celtics ended up beating the Lakers 6 of those years in the finals. But Jerry West, he always did his part in the clutch, whether it was the finals or other key moments. He holds the NBA record for the highest points per game average in a playoff series, just over 46 plus points per game for a series. And he is also the only player in NBA history to be named Finals MVP, despite being on a losing team. That was back in 1969. He took his greatness from on the court to the bench and then to the front office. So, as I said, he achieved greatness across all levels of basketball. After his playing career ended, he took over as head coach of the Lakers for 3 years. And then he led Los Angeles into the playoffs each of those years. He was named GM of the Lakers before the 82-83 NBA season. And under his reign, Los Angeles won 6 championship rings. Loved the Showtime Lakers of that era and their rivalry with the Celtics. We've had some prior far middle dedications that that spoke to that dual team rivalry and those two dynasties of that era. Well, Jerry West, he built that Lakers team. And West won the NBA Executive of the Year award twice. Now, here's the final word on the aura, the reputation of Jerry West. In the 1970s, the Lakers held a Jerry West night. An 11-time NBA champ and his rival and finals nemesis, Bill Russell of the Celtics, he appeared, and here's what he had to say. "Jerry, you are, in every sense of the word, truly a champion. If I could have one wish granted, it would be that you would always be happy." I think that about sums it up. Episode 166 goes to Zeke from Cabin Creek, West Virginia. The logo, aka Jerry West, and his LA ties make for an easy connection to where we left off last episode, which is to discuss a few of what I deemed as hard truths in my talk with the Jonathan Club World Affairs Group downtown in Los Angeles in June. And the complete transcript of that speech can be found on nickdeolias.com if you are interested in reading it. Now, if you read my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America, you're going to recognize these hard truths as familiar themes, albeit now updated with new data and developments. And all of them are blinking danger in red more than when I wrote Precipice. And I'm sorry to have to say that. These hard truths are the major challenges for us reflecting the major tactical avenues of attack that the left has adroitly applied the past number of decades. And you can tie many of these to national levels and back to where I gave the speech, California and LA. Our wonderful nation, the epic state of California, and the great city of Los Angeles, they all once represented the ideal, but now, unfortunately, they're becoming increasingly the playthings of the left. So, okay, let's go review these hard truths. Hard truth number one, government today is a voracious beast, and the bureaucratic state has grossly overstepped its constitutional boundaries. Now, I tag the administrative state as the deep state, oftentimes, and not deep as in secret. I wish it were secret sometimes. No, I reference deep as in rooted and entrenched everywhere and with everything, deep-seated. And there is a historical lineage of how that came to be, from Woodrow Wilson to FDR and the New Deal, of course, Lyndon Johnson, LBJ with his Great Society, Obama, President Obama, to what we've got today, which blows all of those predecessors away. And the individual today can do nothing, frankly, without government approval. And California is in many ways ground zero of the deep state movement. So everything you do today has to be permitted and approved by typically a faceless and unelected bureaucrat. I saw a statistic the other day that sort of shocked me. 25%, a quarter of all the jobs in this nation that have been added since COVID, they're in government. And that's going to diminish our efficacy as an economy and a society greatly. Now, hard truth number two, the U.S. government is guaranteed to either default or devalue on its debt and its commitments moving forward. We're closing in on $35 trillion in debt. That's 120%+ of GDP. And we haven't seen that level proportionally of debt since World War II. We're also running up $2 trillion in annual deficits to add to the debt pile. And then we've got hundreds of trillions of dollars in entitlement promises that don't get added to the official debt. So the government trustees themselves, this is coming from trustees of the government that are a little bit, going to be somewhat, I guess, biased towards lowballing the numbers. They themselves say Social Security has a $25+ trillion shortfall, Medicare, $52+ trillion shortfall. You add those two together using the trustee numbers, that's a $78 trillion shortfall combined. And then here's a statistic that this is probably one of the most frightening statistics from my perspective. See what you think. $1 trillion of new debt, of new government debt on the federal government side is being added to the $35+ trillion debt pile every, how long do you think it takes to add $1 trillion in additional new debt? It takes 100 days. That's it. Every 100 days, our debt goes up on the federal government side by $1 trillion. Yeah, the fiscal plane is flying right into the mountain, and there is not going to be enough time or space to gain sufficient altitude. Default or devalue, got to pick your poison, and both indeed are poison. And that, by the way, the plight of the federal government's finances and its fiscal situation is very similar to that for places like California. I saw that Governor Newsom recently was asked a question about the serious or severe turn in California's finances. He was asked, can we explain to Californians how we move from a $100 billion surplus to such a significant deficit in just a matter of a few years? And his answer was very interesting. He said, delay in tax collections due to rain bombs and atmospheric rivers, which proved climate change has impacts. Right. Don't look there. Look over here instead. Okay, hard truth number three. Our education system, it's broken, perhaps beyond repair. Student proficiency rates, whether it's English, math, science, they've all declined sharply across all grade levels and across the nation, including places like the Los Angeles Unified School District. Student proficiency levels, they haven't come close to recovering to where they were before pandemic. And a lot of districts across this nation are now lowering the passing score on high school exit exams. Why? So that statistics will show that more seniors graduated. It's all for the optics. It's form over substance, ideology over reality. And in many ways, that's becoming the new mottos of our nation's public education system, which is sad to report. The demographic that pays the heaviest price, of course, are going to be the poorest. We always see that. As of 2019, two-thirds of African-American 12th graders didn't possess even partial mastery of basic 12th grade math. We talked about that on a recent prior episode of The Far Middle. And the number who are advanced in math was so small, it didn't show up statistically in the national data. It's pretty much the same story in reading competency. Half of African-American 12th graders don't possess even partial mastery of basic reading, and only 4% were advanced. We talked about how these statistics should infuriate. You are assigning, as a nation, a generation to unrealized potential, and we're dooming them to a life unfulfilled. But for what and why? Well, we know the answers to that, to instead have the system serve the desires of special interests who could not care less about the quality of life and future prospects of millions of Americans that they're supposed to be focused upon with regard to education. And that's why you see things like funding levels skyrocketing over decades as competency scores have declined. So that really raises the question, as we've raised before on The Far Middle, do we truly care about our kids? And sometimes when you look at the state of our public education system, you have to wonder. But it's not much better with higher education when you look at this hard truth. Academia went from, right, the marketplace of ideas to what is now an iron curtain of ideology. Went from where a student was challenged and expanded its horizons, his or her horizons, to one where the student is now coddled and the student comes out indoctrinated with narrower horizons than when they entered college. And the most common grade gifted at Harvard, and I do use the term gifted because that's basically what's going on. The most common grade gifted at Harvard these days is, well, if you guessed an A, you are correct. Hard truth number four, inflation. I think we dedicated a couple months back a Far Middle episode to the inflation situation. Inflation, unfortunately, is here to stay, despite what short-term data might sort of gravitate towards the positive or negative and how people want to sort of extrapolate that out. Inflation, indeed, is here to stay. On the business news networks, everybody gets excited when you see that data point come in with inflation being a tick lower than expected, and how, you know, hopefully inflation is now tamed in the Federal Reserve. They can start cutting rates again. Again, cumulatively, over the bigger picture, that's all hogwash. Unabated growth in the regulatory state, it's going to make everything more expensive. Languishing worker productivity creates skill scarcity. It means more cost per unit of output. Climate alarmism, it's making the kilowatt hour, the horsepower, both more expensive and scarce. And everything relies on either kilowatt hours or horsepower. Hyper-government spending creates private sector scarcity, pushes out private sector investment and increases costs. Taxes, they're going up everywhere and for everything. And the tax tab is going to be passed on inevitably through the stream of commerce. So that's going to stoke inflation. And then you got the Fed's free money policies that pump asset bubbles. It motivates excessive outspending. Crime adds to costs. Geopolitics. We could spend episodes on that of the far middle. That stresses already brittle supply chains. Yeah, this isn't our parents' inflation from the 1970s. This inflation is driven by policy, and it's stoked by ideology. And until the policies and ideologies reverse, inflation is here for the duration, as the cost of living in places like California attest. Yeah, John Adams, President Adams, was right with his famous line, "Facts are stubborn things." You know, they make for hard truths indeed. And sadly, the rest of America is gravitating toward where California is because the left, as we talked about many times on the far middle, it never sleeps. It's always growing by consuming the value of others, day by day, profession by profession, state by state. In the words of ZZ Top, it's going nationwide. Now, I want to add a far middle extra or bonus for all of you constant listeners to provide a special edition hard truth that I did not discuss explicitly at the Jonathan Club World Affairs Group speech. And that is, let's call it hard truth number 5, which is how today's radicalized form of environmentalism is increasingly anti-progress and, frankly, anti-human. Radical environmentalism looks to convert bounty into scarcity. And there's a great example occurring as we speak within California. So it could have been very fitting for that speech. And by the way, it's got nothing to do with electric vehicles or climate change policies, which we've discussed extensively in the past on this podcast. Instead, it has to do with a 3-inch fish, commonly known as the smelt. Now, some of you who may not be avid fishermen or experts on aquatic life may nevertheless be familiar with the smelt. That's because the smelt is a culinary treat enjoyed by Italians and other Southern European cultures or nationalities, particularly around Christmas time. So when I hear smelt, I think of eating. But when a California farmer in the Central Valley hears smelt, he or she thinks trouble, and for good reason. You see, despite California being immersed in water after record-breaking rains erased years of serious drought, California did not manifest that bounty into good news for farmers in the Central Valley. That's because California environmental policies, coupled with federal environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, have methodically broken the once world-class infrastructure of water delivery in California. And that translates into crisis for one of the world's leading agricultural centers, California's Central Valley. That area serves as America's not so much breadbasket, but fruit and vegetable basket. The Central Valley is a top producer of almonds and pistachios, tomatoes, host of other fruits and vegetables, and chances are you eat what that region grows. Now, farmers in California's Central Valley are only getting 40% of the federal water that they are supposed to receive this year. And you might wonder, how can that be with California enjoying very high water levels after those rains and snows? It goes back to environmental policy that favors the 3-inch smelt over not just the farmer, but also the consumer of the farmer's crop harvest, which are everyday Americans, most of all the working poor and middle class. Yes, environmentalism increasingly views the smelt as more important than the human. The way California's water infrastructure works, to summarize it in very simple fashion, it basically takes water collected mostly Northern California, which is wetter, and pumps it through infrastructure to the drier southern parts of the state. And the flow rate of water going through that infrastructure has been purposely slowed to protect the smelt that is migrating during parts of the year. And that's why the farmer in the Central Valley is getting less than half the allotment of water he or she was supposed to receive. So what do you do if you're that farmer? Well, one of the most common reactions is to plant fewer crops in what is one of the most fertile agricultural areas, not just in the nation, but in the world. It sounds crazy because one would think that with California's drought now solved, farmers in one of the most fertile growing regions on the planet would be expanding their fields, not shrinking them. But that would ignore the impact of the bureaucrat and the environmentalist and the ideology of radicalized environmentalism, using the smelt as a convenient prop. By the way, the entity that decides to curtail water to farmers is the Bureau of Reclamation within the United States federal government, along with, of course, willing assistance from California regulators. Now, here's what a farm manager had to say about this illogical situation. There's no reason for it, and it's dangerous for the country. You don't know how to plan. Exactly right. And then he also added, you kind of come to a standstill. Now, that manager summarized the overarching strategy of the radical environmental movement. Bring human endeavors and value-creating activities to a standstill, at a minimum. And ideally, the radical environmentalist aims to eradicate such activity altogether, permanently. And it shouldn't surprise you that studies have found a strong correlation between local poverty in the Central Valley and available water. Farmers know that every drop of water in the Central Valley creates jobs, which means the opposite, unfortunately, is also true. If you deny water to the agriculture industry in the Central Valley, you're going to destroy jobs and create poverty. The environmental movement has used the courts and the appeasing regulator to have the Endangered Species Act be applied to saving what is touted as a severely endangered species, the smelt. But the data used to warrant such is extremely suspect, and farmers have pointed out that the fish said to be at risk from water pumping infrastructure includes hatchery bred fish, which isn't what the Endangered Species Act is supposed to be protecting. The owner of a well-known farm in the Central Valley said, "The Endangered Species Act has become a weapon to strip water from the farmers." Indeed, it has, consistent with the playbook of the radical environmental movement across a host of industries for what is now running on decades. So now Governor Newsom in California apparently has an answer for all of this. And can you guess what it is? Well, true to form, the obvious answer of placing the human before the smelt and allowing the Central Valley farmers to receive their full allotment of water, that makes too much sense and is thus unacceptable to the governor. No, instead, the governor wants to spend $20 billion of taxpayer money to build a tunnel to bypass the river system so that the threatened smelt can swim undisturbed. And I wonder how long that tunnel would take to build based on California's track record of infrastructure for boondoggles like high-speed rail. And I wonder how much of a cost increase one would see from the initial $20 billion price tag. But we probably don't need to worry about those questions and their answers, because ironically and unsurprisingly, environmental groups strongly oppose the construction of the tunnels, proving once again, the radical environmental movement has never been interested in solutions to these proffered problems or crises, whether it be the endangered smelt or Code Red for Humanity. Instead, the ideology and religion of radical environmentalism, they demand no solutions other than stopping the value-creating activity and eradicating all individual choice, and replacing both with a theocracy that is based upon penance for the sin of good quality of life and approval for any and all activity moving forward. That's our future, constant listeners. If the left is left unchecked, and if things like climate policies and radical environmentalism continue to run amok, just ask a farmer in California's Central Valley, or give it a thought the next time you're in the grocery store looking to buy your tomatoes. In the end, whether it is the hard truths that we covered or the bonus truth of what happens with radicalized environmental policy, we can take all of those and wrap them into a connection as to how government, when it seeks to supplant the private sector, typically ends up making things worse. And the bigger the endeavor or the policy, the worse it's going to get. Now, there was a piece by Andy Kessler recently that I came across where he did a great job of providing example after example of this phenomenon at play across the United States. And I can share a few of the examples that he called out, which were awesome illustrations. One that is more recent in the news was when our government attempted to build and succeeded in spending over $300 million for a floating dock in Gaza so that aid could be more easily and efficiently delivered to Gazans suffering from the war. I think it was Senator Vance out of Ohio who quipped, "The Gaza Pier is a symbol of the Biden administration, a horrible idea executed terribly." Yeah, the pier concept did not last reality very long. The taxpayers, they're out over $300 million, and everyday people in Gaza are no better off. And then there is the almost comical situation with electric vehicle chargers. The 2021 infrastructure bill set aside over $7 billion of spending And the administration promised to use that money to build 500,000 electric vehicle chargers by 2030. Now, this task fell under the Department of Transportation and its secretary, Mayor Pete. So how has he done? Well, you know, as of May of this year, a grand total of eight electric vehicle chargers have been installed. So you do the math to figure out how long it will take to get to the promised 500,000 electric vehicle chargers, and your calculator will say more than 100,000 years. And no one bats an eye because it's government and what we unfortunately have come to expect and accept. Now, healthcare drives the massive present value of those future entitlement promises that we discussed in one of our hard truths. Well, a Kaiser survey found that individual insurance premiums between 2010, when Obamacare was enacted, and 2022 were up 58%. Family healthcare premiums rose more than 63%. And inflation was only a fraction of those hikes over the same period, coming in at roughly 36%. Government policy made healthcare much more expensive, and the quality of that healthcare has often declined. And another truth was the sad state of education in the United States, right? That's one of the hard truths that we covered. Well, since the Education Department was founded in 1979, spending per student has skyrocketed. But what's happened to student competencies and the overall quality of their education? You know the answer. Today we see 40 to 60% of first-year college students taking remedial classes in English, math, or both. 40 to 60% of incoming college students. Taxpayers have been forced to spend a king's ransom to dumb down the next generation of Americans, all of it brought to us by big government and its mega policies across the educational complex. Alrighty, let's enjoy a final connection before calling a wrap on this installment of The Far Middle. Something perhaps a little pop culture and a little bit supernatural. Okay, we just said the Department of Education was established in 1979. That's also the year a movie came out that told the story of a Long Island family that was terrorized in their new home by evil spirits. The 1979 movie was based off of a 1977 book, and estimates of the sales of the book are around 10 million copies, and your host proudly owns one of those copies. I'm talking about the Amityville Horror, constant listeners. I was mesmerized, terrified, obsessed with that story that took its name from the small New York City suburban town on the shore of Long Island when I was a kid, just starting to read grown-up books. And the book does a much better job than the movie, but that's typically the case, right? And the story, just a warning ahead of time to make sure you got the lights on. In November 1974, Ron DeFeo Jr. shot and killed six members of his family at 112 Ocean Avenue. A large Dutch colonial house had two evil-looking windows in the upstairs corners that made it appear as if the house had eyes. Now, he claimed voices made him do it. He was convicted and sent to prison for effectively life, and he died in prison in 2021. The Amityville house was empty for 13 months after the murders. And then in December 1975, George and Kathy Lutz bought the house for a bargain price of $80,000. Now, I'm no real estate expert, but I assume a recent mass murder occurring in the home, that's going to create a relative bargain. And during their first inspection of the house, the real estate broker told them about the murders and asked if this would be a problem with the decision. After discussing the matter over, they decided that it was not a problem. And that was a big mistake, constant listeners. Kathy and George, they move in with three young kids, ages 5 through 9, and a dog. I remember the dog's name for some reason. It was Harry. And much of the DeFeo family's furniture was still in the house. It came with the house. George and Kathy decide to have a Catholic priest bless the house. When the priest flicked the first holy water and began to pray, he heard a masculine voice demanding that he get out. So he left. But he failed to mention the incident to either George or Kathy, at least initially. So I'm not going to spoil the story for you. Suffice to say, there are aspects of what happened to the Lutzes that are beyond scary. And I implore you to read the book if you enjoy horror. And after about a month living there, that's all they lasted, I think 28 days to be specific, the Lutzes ran out of the house, claimed to have been terrorized by paranormal phenomena, and were basically never to return. They basically left all their stuff there and had someone else, a mover, pick it up later. Now, the debate continues concerning the accuracy of the Amityville Horror. George Lutz maintained that events in the book were what he called mostly true. And I'm not tempting fate. Look at it this way. If only a fraction of that Lutz story was true, that's still beyond terrifying. And certainly terrifying to the 13-year-old version of your host when I first read it. And still terrifying to me at episode 166 of The Far Middle. Okay, keep the lights on as you stay connected to that far middle.